welcome to another episode of The Art Salon. My name is Nico Bejarano. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already, and to follow us on social media at The Art Salon on Instagram to keep up with our latest guests and other announcements. And finally, if you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform. It helps other people find the show, and it makes us feel good about what we're doing here. I'm very excited to share with you what I have in store for you this month, but I will do that later, maybe in a week or so. For now, I wanted to release this episode about some of my thoughts about what happened at American Youth Symphony, where I was director of development for the better part of a year and a half. Bear in mind, this write-up is a little bit stream of consciousness, and within it is also my analysis of the announcement and the situation that's been unfolding at the San Francisco Symphony with Esa-Pekka Salonen announcing his departure. So without further ado, here we go. I open this with Jorge Luis Borges' story, El Aleph. There's this image where the person he loved has died, and he is offended by the fact that advertisements have changed, which shows that despite this meaning a lot to him, the world keeps going. I will read it first in its original Spanish, and then I will read it in English. La candente mañana de febrero en que Beatriz Viterbo murió, después de una imperiosa agonía que no se rebajó un solo instante ni al sentimentalismo ni al miedo. Noté que las carteleras de fierro de la Plaza Constitución habían renovado no sé qué aviso de cigarrillos rubios. El hecho me dolió, pues comprendí que el incesante y vasto universo ya se apartaba de ella, y que ese cambio era el primero de una serie infinita. Cambiaré el universo, pero yo no, pensé con melancólica vanidad. Alguna vez, lo sé, mi vana devoción la había exasperado. Muerta, yo podía consagrarme a su memoria, sin esperanza, pero también sin humillación. On the burning February morning, Beatriz Viterbo died, after braving an agony that never for a single moment gave way to self-pity or fear. I noticed that the sidewalk billboards around Constitución Plaza were advertising some new brand or other of American cigarettes. The fact pained me, for I realized that the wide and ceaseless universe was already slipping away from her, and that this slight change was the first of an endless series. The universe may change, but not me, I thought with a certain sad vanity. I knew that at times my fruitless devotion had annoyed her. Now that she was dead, I could devote myself to her memory, without hope, but also without humiliation. By now, the news of the closure of American Youth Symphony has spread like wildfire. It is hardly necessary to explain what this means to many musicians in Los Angeles, but the impact to many nationally might be obscure. AYS was one of the very few truly impactful youth music programs in the nation, along with the Civic Orchestra of Chicago, the New World Symphony, and the Orchestra Now in New York. Although AYS was somewhat smaller in scope, it nonetheless was the most prolific of these in helping musicians enter the competitive Los Angeles freelance scene. This was naturally due to its location in Los Angeles, and perhaps more importantly, it was because so many of its alumni had grown into prominent careers as movie composers, contractors, administrators, and performers. Whether its young members were aware of it or not, and this awareness did vary greatly, winning a spot in AYS represented admittance into an illustrious club and network whose members dominate the Los Angeles classical music scene. Since the closure announcement, it has been breathtaking to see how many powerful musicians got their start at AYS. While AYS might not have been the determining factor in making or breaking many careers, the general sentiment is that it was one of the crucial ones for many musicians who benefited from the program. The most common question I have received since the closure of AYS became public has been, what happened? Everyone seems surprised that an organization so vital to the ecosystem of Los Angeles could disappear so suddenly and unceremoniously. Many things led to this moment, and no one illness killed this patient. I'm not here to spill the tea or to do a post-mortem on the organization, but rather to give some thought about what AYS's demise tells us about the state of the classical music sector. While the loss of this organization will be devastating long term, its disappearance will no doubt be nothing but a passing pain in due course. I have spent the entirety of my professional administrative career in small nonprofits. These organizations are challenging to steer and especially susceptible to mercurial societal trends. They are also, however, agile and adaptive in ways that behemoth institutions like the Metropolitan Opera or the Los Angeles Philharmonic can only dream of. Due to their nature, I have often remarked that small organizations have a better sense of the inherent risks embedded in the industries they inhabit, and, if daring, also can test solutions for industry problems at a lower cost. If the sector as a whole, for example, is experiencing audience depletion, a small organization will sense this danger first, since it more closely affects the bottom line. If boards of directors are experiencing exhaustion and cyclical challenges, a small organization will sense this as existential, and so on. Thanks to these fine-tuned antennae and their ability to try new ideas, small organizations are the first line of defense alerting the sector of the dangers ahead. As such, AYS was pained by many of the same issues that threaten larger classical music organizations. Small audiences, shrinking patronage, the potential end to the philanthropic class, the abandoning of foundation priorities after 2020, and many more. Ahead, I lay out the many issues that crippled AYS and that I see are crippling other parts of the sector. First is a segment I called Audiences and Audience Affinity. It has been a well-known fact that audiences to classical music events are limited. To some degree, this has been the case for most of my lifetime. As musicians, we are accustomed to concert halls being half-empty, and we have become lulled to the real threat of this by our complacency. To some degree, due to the economic underpinnings that sustain symphony orchestras, these ensembles operate regardless of concert attendance. This seems counterintuitive, because in any other industry, a lack of consumers would immediately collapse any business. How can orchestras rely so little on audiences? The simple answer is that ticket sales only represent about 30% of most orchestras' revenue. It has been over a century since symphony orchestras have been able to sustain their operations based on ticket sales alone. With significant increases in production costs, orchestras have become more and more dependent on contributed revenue. In episode 52 of this podcast, I talked with Robert Flanagan about his book, The Perilous Life of Symphony Orchestras, where he goes into great detail about some of the financial realities facing the performing arts sector. His main preoccupation throughout is the threat of Baumol's cost disease. Baumol's cost disease, also known as the Baumol effect, is an economic concept that explains how wages in labor-intensive industries tend to increase over time, even if there's no improvements in productivity. The main idea behind Baumol's cost disease is that some sectors of the economy, such as the performing arts, have inherently low productivity growth compared to other sectors. In these sectors, it is difficult to increase output per worker without sacrificing quality. As wages rise in more productive sectors of the economy, like manufacturing, workers in less productive sectors expect to receive similar wage increases, even if their productivity has not increased. This leads to a rise of costs in these sectors over time, even though there has been no increase in output or productivity. As wages in other industries increase due to productivity growth, orchestras must also raise musicians' salaries to remain competitive. This leads to a continual increase in labor costs for orchestras, while productivity remains the same. Baumol's cost disease explains how orchestras have become so reliant on the generosity of private funders, foundations, and government grants. We are truly lucky in the classical music industry to be the benefactors of such generosity, and to be the custodians of a cultural treasure that so many patrons have deemed worth saving despite its intrinsic material unprofitability. Over the proscenium arch in Royce Hall at UCLA, where the American Youth Symphony performed for 6 decades, there is a quote from the university's founder, Ernest Carroll Moore, that has always stayed with me. Quote, "Education is learning to use the tools which the race has found indispensable." Close quote. For centuries, the West has deemed classical music to be indispensable. But our financial disconnection from audiences has made ignoring their needs and desires a very easy proposition. This leads to the next big question. Are we convinced of our culture? Is classical music elitist? Whether as classical musicians we believe that the monumental masterpieces that make up our repertoire are worth promoting and protecting, it is clear to me that we are continuously failing in our duty to excite and convince our audiences that they are. We are essentially taking our dear audiences for granted. Classical music organizations, including American Youth Symphony, have watched audiences shrink but have been paralyzed by several cognitive biases, most notably the gambler's fallacy, the illusion of validity, reactive devaluation, and the ostrich effect. Gambler's fallacy is believing that the future probabilities are altered by past events when in fact they are unchanged. For example, the conveyor belt broke 3 times last month. It's pretty unlikely it'll happen again. The illusion of validity is overestimating our ability to make accurate predictions, especially when data appears to tell us a coherent story. For example, this worked fine in the factory in Korea. It should work fine here. Reactive devaluation is when we devalue an idea because it originated from an adversary or opponent. For example, our competition are only doing well because their products are cheap. Finally, the ostrich effect, which is avoiding negative financial information by pretending it doesn't exist. For example, looks like we've run out of time to discuss this. In many cases, most attempted solutions, copied from other organizations, promising to rejuvenate audiences and pack concert halls, tend to be nothing but snake oil. The most notable proposed failed solutions have included the implementation of pay-what-you-can models, whose failure is well documented in other industries, poor marketing strategies, and a significant pivot in repertoire choices in favor of ultimately unpopular offerings. The general sense in many of the proposed solutions is one of a lack of conviction in the product, namely classical music. Classical musicians are often heard apologizing for producing something they seem to find unsexy. This betrays a bizarre reflex in a never-ending plight to avoid that dreaded E-word, elitism. Before diving into the question of whether classical music is elitist, I would first like to say a thing or two about the product itself. There is no mind in my mind that, culturally speaking, classical music has some of the most powerful creations known to man. It is still hard to imagine how human beings like Bach, Monteverdi, Handel, Mozart, Beethoven, Sibelius, Shostakovich, Mahler, or Wagner could bring into existence the many gifts they gifted humanity. These works hold a special place in our consciousness because they capture so many inexpressible elements of what it means to be human and what it means to aspire to overcome our condition. These masterpieces transcend entertainment, welcoming listeners into a world beyond our own. These works challenge us and demand an openness that is not present in other artistic expressions, and in exchange, they reward us with a deep humanity that more surface-level entertainment cannot. No doubt such spiritual experiences demand a commitment from audiences and inhabit physical spaces that seem foreign to the casual existence of modernity. But, as custodians of this repertoire, and these cathedrals of sound, we must stop putting ourselves in defensive stances. I, for one, am convinced that art of this magnitude is not only constantly relevant, but more importantly, its natural depth makes it uniquely suited to feed our humanity in times of deep need. This was a well-understood reality only 100 years ago. There is a fictitious quote attributed to Winston Churchill that makes the rounds on social media from time to time and goes like this. In the middle of World War II, Churchill is asked to cut arts funding to support the war effort, to which he replies, "Then what are we fighting for?" It would be fortuitous if this anecdote were real, but it is only an invention that feeds artists' wishful thinking. We do, however, have reason to think this anecdote could be true. After all, Churchill's war entourage did have many who thought the battle against Herr Hitler was one for the preservation of Western culture. Most notably among them was the de facto manager of Britain's war effort during World War I and World War II, John Maynard Keynes. A seemingly unbelievable thing happened during World War I, when Keynes traveled to war-torn France to purchase and save several important pieces by Degas, Manet, Delacroix, Cézanne, and others. Here's a retelling by Jason Zweig. A few months ago, I stumbled on the story of how Keynes did a brilliant debt-for-equity swap in 1918, using his formidable powers of persuasion to tap the British Treasury for enough money to buy numerous masterpieces of French art for the National Gallery in London. Keynes rightly predicted that the French would be able to repay their massive war debts to Britain only in a currency so badly depreciated that the loans would be a total loss. So, Keynes realized Britain could instead buy paintings at the upcoming auction in Paris for the estate of the great artist Edgar Degas. Instead of extending yet another loan to France, the British could buy artistic masterpieces, effectively replacing a bad debt with great art, whose value would likely go up, not down, over time. The auction offered not only works of art by Degas himself, but by many other artists whose works he admired, including Manet, Delacroix, Cézanne, Ingres, and Gauguin. Keynes conscripted the National Gallery's director, Charles Holmes, and got the Treasury to provide £20,000, approximately $1.3 million today, to buy art. Holmes bought about 24 great paintings and drawings with the money Keynes had wheedled out of the Treasury, and Keynes bought 4 works of art for himself with his money. Keynes believed that the test of a successful economy was how much opportunity it gave people to spend their leisure time appreciating the beauty of the world around them. Today's world is much richer monetarily than Keynes could have ever imagined when he died in 1946. Whether our souls are richer is another question. We would all be better off if we shut off our phones every once in a while and invested more time in serenity, attention, and the contemplation of great works of the human imagination. The strength of Keynes's conviction that the West's artistic treasures hold a universal cultural value that must be salvaged at any cost for the future generations should be a model for every person working in classical music institutions, museums, universities, and other such cultural organizations. It has been my experience in my time in the cultural sector that such a conviction is under attack and eroding at an alarming pace. nurturing such convictions has come to be seen as elitist, for reasons that fail to convince me. As I said earlier, this seems a bizarre reflex in a never-ending plight to avoid charges of elitism. I truly don't believe classical music is elitist, nor are the institutions that present it. But it is undeniable that this is a perception that has cemented itself not only in outsiders, but most worryingly in the people whose duty it is to serve as the custodians of the arts. The perception of classical music as elitist can be attributed to several factors. Because most of the classical music canon was written a long time ago, classical music has long been seen as something old, associated with royalty, aristocracy, and the upper class. No doubt the aristocracy and upper classes have been patrons of the arts, but the idea that concerts were presented to only wealthy segments of the population belies the historical reality that since the 19th century, classical music concerts and professional orchestras have been serving large constituencies and surviving mostly thanks to the enthusiasm of the middle and upper middle class. The idea that only aristocrats and wealthy people attended concerts is ahistorical and a fiction that we frankly need to stop living with. We also live in an era that promotes the ridiculous idea that anything old is elitist. This notion presents an existential dilemma for classical arts. Old things are not elitist, they're just old. They don't correspond exactly to our modern sensitivities, not because they are designed for an elite, but rather because they are intrinsically cemented in a time foreign to our own. Shakespearean English is not hard to read because it was designed to be read in gilded halls by old men in tweed jackets. It simply reflects the common dialect of the Elizabethan era. Other art forms are similarly performed in anachronistic fashion. For example, famed jazz clubs like the Blue Note or the Birdland are of a bygone era, but not by that logic elitist. Indeed, appreciating classical music often requires formal education or exposure from a young age, which is an opportunity only some have had. However, with the advent of platforms like YouTube or Spotify, the availability of recordings is cheaper than ever. This is coupled with the availability of cheap tickets at many venues, which not only offer significant discounts for students, but also offer significantly discounted tickets at many family-oriented events each season. The perceived barrier to entry for many cultural offerings is more often than not strictly in our heads. Classical music has a messaging problem owing to its perceived complexity. While intricate compositions and the technical skills required to perform classical music can make it seem intimidating or challenging to understand for those unfamiliar with the genre, they are also the genre's strongest assets. People are attracted to spectacle and virtuosity. Many things in life are interesting, but not endlessly so. Many popular cultural products are easily digestible and require very little commitment from the consumer, but they are not endlessly interesting. Over time, most cultural products that are shallow become tiring because their sustenance is limited. While selling classical music is challenging, without a doubt, the cultural product, so to speak, is endlessly interesting. And just as artists misunderstand the consumers, many artists misunderstand the business. I started doing administrative work pretty early in my artistic career. Since entering the space, I have become alarmed by the lack of knowledge artists have about the way the sector operates. This afflicted American Youth Symphony in some ways and is palpable in the aftermath of Esa-Pekka Salonen's announcement that he will be departing the San Francisco Symphony. In the days after AYS closed, many of the orchestra's alumni and other musicians in the sector took to social media to blame the board and shame donors for their perceived apathy. Many of these musicians are relatively affluent, but only a small minority of those complaining made recurring donations to support AYS's mission. A similar trend has taken hold in California as people signed letters shaming the San Francisco Symphony's Board of Governors for failing to extend Esa-Pekka Salonen's contract past the 24-25 season. Musicians seem to think that an orchestra's biggest donors and supporters, its board of directors, represent the organization's largest financial and artistic enemies. Let's clarify the general business model that supports classical ensembles. If an orchestra is thriving in its ticket sales, this means roughly 30 to 40% of the organization's income is being earned. The rest of the money that is necessary to cover the expenses involved in producing a season must be secured from non-contributed income. This includes any dividends produced by an organization's endowment, donations from individuals, and contributions from private foundations and government agencies. What this means is that if we're being generous, 60% of all expenses are not being covered by the consumers, but rather by charitable contributions. In a recent article in the San Francisco Classical Voice, the financial realities of the orchestra were laid bare in clear terms. For the last available data, of the San Francisco Symphony's $78.6 million in operating expenses, only 34%, that's $26.9 million, were covered by earned revenue, ticket sales. This means, out of SAPECA's 2022 salary of $2,065,642, only $702,318 is potentially covered by ticket sales. A similar calculation can be made for the orchestra's CEO salary, or indeed any of the musicians whose salaries are a matter of public record. For example, the orchestra's concertmaster's salary, $317,113, would be closer to $106,798 if it weren't for the non-earned income. I invite you to peruse the orchestra's 2022-990 form to do this didactic exercise yourself. It has been my experience that musicians who begin their claims about the issues facing the music industry by saying, "I know what I'm worth," are typically the least knowledgeable of their actual market value or matters of institutional finances. Another source of contention in the discussions about money allocations is the endowment. American Youth Symphony did not have an endowment, but the San Francisco Symphonies is one of the largest in the nation. Endowments are financial assets that are typically donated to a nonprofit organization with the stipulation that the principal amount is maintained intact and only the investment income or a small percentage of the principal can be used for the organization's ongoing operations or specific purposes. The main reasons organizations don't simply use the money in the endowment outright are mainly tied to sustainability. Endowments provide a stable and reliable source of income over the long term. By only using a portion of the investment returns, organizations can ensure that they have funds available for many years, even indefinitely. An endowment's long-term nature is the reason that they are so popular in the eyes of donors who contribute extraordinary gifts to an organization, since they are designed to preserve the original donation in perpetuity or for a specified period. By only using the income generated from the endowment, the organization can protect the principal amount from being depleted over time. It is precisely the fact that musicians and administrators may prefer to cover immediate needs, such as salary increases or concert hall renovations, with funds in an endowment that makes their restricted nature somewhat important. After all, endowments often provide funding for specific programs, scholarships, or other initiatives that are vulnerable to market fluctuations or may not be possible with regular operating funds. Endowments provide financial stability, especially during economic downturns or when the funding sources are limited. The income from the endowment can help the organization maintain its operations and continue its mission, even as they are forced to make other sacrifices. While it might anger us that wealthy people prefer endowments, it's important to remember that professional performing arts institutions globally have typically evolved in the shadow of affluent cosmopolitan communities, and to pretend that performers can survive without their support is an ahistorical fantasy. Until musicians take it upon themselves to understand and come to terms with the financial realities of their ecosystem, they will continue to engage in a confrontational relationship with the administrators who keep the trains running on time and with the donors and patrons who support their lifestyles. So what now for the sector? It has been a month since the closure of American Youth Symphony, and I keep asking myself, what now? This question is both personal, as I find a new place to work, but more interestingly, it is one for the orchestral music circuit in general. My sense that AYS's demise is but a microcosm of the larger sector can be seen in real time in San Francisco. I don't think anyone has any clear answers about what the future of the orchestral music world looks like, but we should all be in agreement that many things are not working at many levels. I've been asked what kind of message the closure of AYS sends to aspiring orchestral musicians. Won't they be discouraged by the lack of opportunities? If AYS cannot thrive in a city like Los Angeles, is there a future for classical music in America? The answers to these and other questions are hard to articulate, but in short, the message this sends to young musicians is that they need to be more savvy than their predecessors. The era of big record contracts, large philanthropic endeavors, and overzealous collective bargaining contract negotiations have been behind us for at least 20 years. The time for sacrifice, commitment, and entrepreneurship is ahead. We must resist the urge to blame any segment of the industry's delicate ecosystem. Management will blame the generally overzealous collective bargaining agreements which strain financial realities. Artists will blame boards and management for their lack of commitment and imagination. Boards will blame management for their inability to produce more donors and large audiences, and so on ad nauseum. In reality, we are all a little bit to blame for the state of our industry, and as such, we must analyze our own faults as well as our unique responsibilities. One thing that unites all parties in our shared guilt is our loss of noblesse oblige. Noblesse oblige is a French term that translates to nobility obliges. It refers to the idea that those who are privileged or noble are expected to act with honor, generosity, and responsibility toward those less privileged. It suggests that with great power or status comes the duty to act with benevolence and kindness towards others. This concept has been applied not only to the aristocracy, but also more broadly to anyone in a privileged position. In the moneyed classes, noblesse oblige typically expresses itself through charity and philanthropy. But as performers and administrators, we have forgotten that we too have a role to play and a duty towards our communities as the custodians of great artistic achievements. Our privilege is that we get to make a living doing something we love. Have we forgotten how fortunate we are to be paid to spend all day in the company of Beethoven, Shakespeare, Degas, etc.? Our profession is itself a privilege we cannot lose track of and often do. For over a century, American cultural institutions have been the great beneficiaries of multi-generational noblesse oblige. The power of American universities, museums, orchestras, and other artistic institutions is the result of heroic supporters who wish to enrich the nation's culture and beauty. Unfortunately, as the baby boomer generation's time is at its twilight, the interest in philanthropy is declining in America for the first time in generations. As institutions, we have certainly failed to appeal to the Silicon Valley billionaires and yuppies who would be the natural successors to the philanthropists who have championed American culture over the last centuries. Until we can reverse this trend, the industry as a whole must adapt or perish, and we must all play our part. One thing is for certain. We have been dealing hammer blows to the concept of noblesse oblige since 2020, and society has decided on a concept of noblesse culpabilité. Nobility guilt, pushing the idea that nobility or privilege causes guilt rather than obligation. Just like Essa Pekka resigned with a message of culpability towards others, AYS fans took to Facebook to guilt the parties that allowed its demise. This is, in my opinion, counterproductive and discouraging to would-be patrons. While guilt can be a motivator for philanthropy, its half-life is significantly shorter than a sense of obligation. None of us have endless patience for being criticized. As that charming American adage goes, you can catch more flies with honey than vinegar. As a general rule, we must shed the naivete that compels us to seek easy solutions to complicated problems. Due to the myriad issues that threaten the classical music scene, institutions are vulnerable to falling for what I call snake oil solutions to complex issues. Not unlike many patients facing complicated medical diagnoses, classical music institutions are susceptible to any number of spiritualists, crystal healers, juice cleanse gurus, and other assorted well-meaning charlatans and consultants. If I have learned anything in my time in this industry, it is that if a solution sounds simple, institutional custodians must run away from its proponents. In Book 9 of John Milton's epic poem about the fall of man, Paradise Lost, Satan is described thusly as he tempts Eve to taste the forbidden fruit. Quote, "He leading swiftly rolled in tangles and made intricate seem straight, to mischief swift." Close quote. I take this warning with me daily in the classical music industry to avoid all people who offer solutions that make intricate seem straight. The challenges we face are vast, and I hope together we can tackle the many issues that plague us, being mindful to avoid people with one-size-fits-all solutions. As we look ahead as musicians, we must also shed the notion that we are not also important philanthropic agents in our industry. While it is true that most musicians are not affluent enough to make donations in the tens of thousands, they do have at least some capacity to contribute to the arts ecosystem. Some do so by volunteering their time to organizations they believe in, others by donating their fees so ensembles can engage their services, or by providing free or low-cost lessons to promising students, and a few contribute what they can to places that have been instrumental in their careers. But in many cases, particularly in the top echelons of classical music, this sense of duty is sorely missing. There is no shortage of entitlement, but certainly a deficit of noblesse oblige. Can we not all forego an expensive meal once or twice a year to benefit an institution that has helped us on our path? There's another type of heroic sacrificial act that has become rare in the classical music world. a willingness to work for less or forgo fees for particularly important projects. In the aftermath of the San Francisco Symphony Azapeka Salonen debacle, much was made of the cancellation of a number of the Soundbox Series concerts. As the San Francisco Symphony's CEO recently revealed, each Soundbox concert costs roughly $250,000 to produce, but ticket sales only cover 10% of this large cost. Salonen is willing to leave the orchestra over its decision to cut some of these concerts, which he strongly believes should be prioritized during his tenure. Fair enough. I wonder, however, if his conviction is strong enough that he offered to stake his claim by lowering his $2 million salary to cover some of the costs. This type of financial sacrifice has been an important part of the arts ecosystem since the dawn of man. Salonen has good role models to emulate if he believes so strongly that Soundbox and international touring represent the future of classical music. Alfred Hitchcock financed Psycho largely through his own production company, Shamley Productions, in exchange for a 60% ownership stake in the film. This was a significant risk at the time, as the film's subject matter and unconventional narrative structure were considered risky by the major studios. However, the film went on to be a major success, becoming one of Hitchcock's most iconic works and a landmark in the horror genre. George Lucas financed the original Star Wars movie, later retitled Star Wars Episode IV: A New Hope, largely with his own money and by negotiating a reduced director's fee in exchange for full merchandising rights. Like Psycho, Star Wars was initially considered a risky project by the major studios, but went on to become a massive success, spawning a franchise that continues to this day. Similarly, James Cameron financed much of the production of The Terminator himself after struggling to find backing from studios. Cameron took on multiple roles in the production, including writer, director, and editor, and the film became a surprise hit, launching his career as a major filmmaker. Frank Zappa often financed his own orchestral works. Despite Zappa's prominence in the experimental rock world, his orchestral compositions were rarely performed or recorded. Consequently, he decided to finance the performances himself. Despite these challenges, and thanks to Zappa's noblesse oblige, his orchestral works have been acclaimed for their originality and technical prowess, and are now regularly programmed by orchestras in Europe and America. A notorious example from the art world came courtesy of Colombian painter and sculptor Fernando Otero, who sadly passed away in 2023. Fernando Otero was known for his distinctive style characterized by exaggerated proportions and forms. Frustrated by his nation's art museum's poor international collections, and wanting aspiring Colombian artists to have access to world-class masterpieces by European and American artists, he donated his art collection to Colombia. In 2000, Botero donated 208 art pieces, including 123 of his own works and 85 masterworks by other artists such as Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dalí, and Joan Miró, to the Banco de la República in Bogotá, Colombia. This collection is known as the Botero Museum and is housed in a colonial mansion in the historic La Candelaria district of Bogotá. After his death, his daughter recounted that Botero emptied his private collection and that the walls of his home were left naked. He went as far as to repurchase meaningful paintings from his own work to give the museum. When his daughter asked him if he was sure he wanted to give all of his important pieces away, Botero answered, "A gift without pain is not a gift." This is noblesse oblige. My intention is not to shame Salonen, but merely to ask why so many classical music artists of this age seems to be under the impression that they have no controlling stake in or responsibility for the generation of artwork they believe in, other than showing up. It is not entirely the artist's fault. They are constantly affirmed in these positions by well-meaning commentators who promote the idea that Übermensch can move mountains if only others can sacrifice their fortunes at their altars. We're entering a time where showing up is not enough to convince backers to support financially risky projects. We are in an age where heroic acts of sacrifice will be necessary to give orchestras a future. For people seeking a career in a field where showing up from 9 to 5 and being professional and proficient is enough, the arts are a bad place to find this. The issues facing classical music are vast, and the realities sobering. But closing our eyes to those realities is a pathetic way to address them. Like any industry, classical music is going to transform and evolve. I will bank on those artists and patrons willing to commit themselves to projects without the perceived entitlement to present their art to the world, as they will most likely rise in popularity and see some success. We must not forget that classical music concerts are in many ways an act of preservation rather than entertainment strictly designed to generate a profit. As such, we must accept that classical music productions will rarely break through to the general public without some tie into pop culture. So it's important to understand the motivations of philanthropists who want to finance said preservation. It is undeniable that there has been a disconnect in recent years regarding this reality. As AYS joins the ranks of other organizations whose time has come, I remain convinced that there will always be an interest in great music and great art, which is why, as custodians, we must rise to the challenges that lean times can bring. Despite my deep sadness for AYS's demise, I feel nothing but grateful for the many people who contributed to its existence and who will forever be a part of its storied legacy. So, what can the industry learn from AYS's closure? I would say, don't take for granted how delicate the balance of our existence is, and nurture the type of symbiosis that sustains an inherently heroic and unprofitable proposition.